Star and Dr. Noon were united in their belief that Pakistan's nuclear weapons were not the property of the civilian government, nor were they fabricated and stockpiled, at great cost and at great risk, they would hasten to add, only to be used as some sort of hypothetical deterrent, an invisible chess piece. No. Pakistan's nuclear weapons belong to the Ummah, the community of Muslims, and they could and should be used for the good of all believers. And the two scientists believed in Riaz Rehan, and they trusted that now was the right time because he said that now was the right time. The dour foreign men from the Caucasus all around them in the school bus maintenance facility were of the faithful, even if they were not Pakistani Muslims. Doctors Noon and Nishtar did not understand all of what was going on, but they were quite clear on their mission. They were to arm the weapons. They were to oversee the loading of the weapons into the rocket payload containers, and then they were to return to Pakistan with the ISI general, where they would remain in hiding until Rehan told them it was safe to come out in public and take their bow as heroes of the state. Noon and Nishtar had been working for more than 3 hours in the cold warehouse, taking moments to warm their hands over a coal brick stove that had been lit in the corner, so that their fingers would remain pliant for the intricate work of removing the nuclear devices from their MK-84 bomb casings necessary for them to fit in the payload containers. A group of Rehan's personal security force stood by, ready to help with engine hoists and rolling racks. Safronov offered up Jamaat Shariat men for this work, but Rehan refused, told him to keep his gunmen inside the perimeter gates, but ready for any threat from the outside. Once the bombs left Dushanbe, Rehan explained, they would be Safronov's, but for now, Rehan retained possession and his people would handle them. As Noon and Nishtar checked some data on a laptop on a table next to the first payload container, Rehan and Safronov stepped up behind them. The general reached out and put his thick hands on the two men's backs. They continued to work. Doctors, how is your progress? Dr. Nishtar answered while he peered into the container, looking at the configuration of the warhead. Minutes more for this one, and then we begin on the second weapon. We have bypassed the launch code mechanisms, and we have installed the radio altimeter fuses. Show us. Noon pointed out a device bolted to the side of the bomb. It looked like a metal briefcase, and it contained several mechanical parts wired together, as well as a computer keypad and an LED readout. He said, there is a radio altimeter that is already set. When the devices reach an altitude of 60,000 feet, it will arm the weapon, and when it descends to 1,000 feet, it will detonate. There is a backup barometer on the detonator, as well as a manual override for a time detonation, which you will not need for a warhead launch. Also, we will rig a tamper trigger on the door of the payload container, so that if anyone tries to open it to remove the weapon, the nuclear bomb will detonate. Georgie smiled and nodded, appreciative of the men's work on behalf of the Dagestani cause. And you will do the same for the other device?
Of course.
Excellent, Rehan said as his hands patted the men on their shoulders. Carry on. Safronov left the warehouse minutes later, but Rehan lagged behind. He returned to the two nuclear scientists and said, I have one small request for you both.
Anything, General, said Dr. Noon.
90 minutes later, General Rehan embraced Georgi Safronov outside the maintenance garage, and he shook the hand of each one of the Dagestani fighters. He called them brave brothers, and he promised them that if they should be martyred, he would name streets in his country in their honor. Then Rehan, Khan, the PAEC officials, and Rehan's protection detail departed through the front gates of the bus farm in four vehicles, removing with them every trace of their work, and leaving behind the Dagestani fighters and the two Dnieper-1 payload containers. Minutes after that, the Dagestanis themselves departed, the gifts from Pakistan loaded carefully into their tractor trailers for the long drive to the north. John Clark spent an entire morning on a stakeout on a tiny park bench in Pushkin Square, central Moscow. 2 inches of fresh snowfall surrounded him, but the sky was clear and bright. He took full tactical advantage of the temperatures by wearing a heavy coat with a thick fur hood. He imagined that if his own wife sat next to him on this park bench, she would have no idea as to his identity. And that was coming in handy at the moment. Two muscular Frenchmen were also in the park, also looking at the same location Clark had come to stake out. He'd spotted them and a pair of their colleagues the day before. The others were stationed in a van up on Uspensky Perelok, a van that they'd kept running throughout the day and night. Clark had noticed the steaming exhaust on one of his lazy 8 strolls through the neighborhood, just one of dozens of anomalies his fertile tactical mind had seen in the streets surrounding his target's house.
The other anomalies he had, after checking them out, eliminated as potential tip-offs to watchers. But the two Frenchmen in the park and the van that ran all day long in its parking spot meant the men after him were using his target as bait. It did not work for them in Tallinn, but here in Moscow, they would be determined to not fail again. Clark used peripheral vision to watch the front door of the apartment of Oleg Kovalenko. The old Russian spy had not left his home at all the day before, but that had not surprised John Clark much. A pensioner his age would not want to stroll the icy streets of Moscow unless it was necessary. There were likely tens of thousands of elderly shut-ins filling tiny apartments throughout the frozen city this weekend. The day before, he'd bought a mobile phone with prepaid credits in a shopping center. He'd found Kovalenko's phone number in the phone book, and he'd considered just calling the man and asking him for a minute of his time somewhere safe. But Clark had no way of knowing if the ex-KGB officer's phone had been bugged by the French, so he discarded that plan. Instead, he had spent most of the day looking for a way into the Russian's apartment that would not tip off the Frenchman. He got an idea around 2 in the afternoon, when an old woman in a purple cap pushed an old metal rolling cart out of the front entrance of the building and headed west through the square. He followed her into a market where she bought several staples. In the checkout line, Clark stood next to her, used his rusty Russian to strike up a friendly conversation. He was apologetic about his language abilities, explaining he was an American newspaper reporter in town working on a story about how real Muscovites deal with harsh winters. Clark offered to pay for her groceries if she would sit down with him for a quick interview. Svetlana Gasanova was thrilled with the opportunity for company with a handsome young foreigner, and she insisted on taking him back to her flat, she lived right up the street after all, and making him a cup of tea. The watchers in the park were not looking for a couple entering the apartment, and Clark was bundled up in his coat and hood to the point where they could not have identified him without standing 6 inches from his nose. He even carried a bag of groceries to give the impression he belonged in the building. John Clark spent a half hour chatting with the old pensioner. His Russian was strained every minute of his time in her flat, but he smiled a lot and nodded a lot, and he drank the jam-sweetened tea she made for him while she talked about the gas company, her landlord, and her bursitis. Finally, after 4 p.m., the woman seemed to grow tired. He thanked her for her hospitality, took down her address, and promised to send her a copy of the newspaper. She led him to the door of her flat, and he promised to return for a visit on his next trip into Moscow. He headed to the stairwell, tossed the woman's address in an ashtray, and went upstairs instead of down. Clark did not knock at Oleg Kovalenko's door. He had noticed when he entered Ms. Gasanova's flat that the heavy oaken doors in this old building were secured with large, easy-to-defeat pin-tumbler locks. John had created lockpicks days earlier by buying a small set of dental instruments at a pawn shop here in Moscow and then bending them to approximate lockpicks he had used in the past in Russia. From a pouch in his coat pocket, he retrieved his homemade facsimiles of a half-diamond pick, a rake pick, and a tension wrench. Checking up and down the wooden-floored hallway to make certain no one was around, he put the picks in his mouth, then manipulated the tension wrench inside the keyhole, turning it counterclockwise slightly and holding the tension on the wrench with his right pinky finger. Then, with his left hand, he took the rake pick from his mouth and slid it above the tension wrench inside the keyhole. Using both hands while maintaining the pressure on his pinky finger, he slid the pick in and out over the spring-loaded pins, pushing them down into place. After he'd defeated all but 2 of the pins, he replaced the rake pick in his mouth, then took the half-diamond pick, slid it into place in the lock, and slowly manipulated the last 2 pins, pushing them down from back to front. With a satisfying click that he hoped had not made much noise inside the flat, the tension wrench turned on the open cylinder and the bolt opened on the door. Quickly, John placed everything back in his pocket and drew his pistol. He pushed open the door and slid into the kitchen of the tiny flat. Past this, he found himself looking into a darkened and tiny living room. A couch. A tiny coffee table, a television set, an eating table with several liquor bottles on it. Big Oleg Kovalenko sat in a chair at the window looking outside through dirty blinds, his back to the room. In English, Clark said, "How much time before they know I'm here?" Kovalenko started, stood from the chair, and turned around. His hands were empty, otherwise Clark would have pumped a .45 caliber round into his fat belly. The big Russian grabbed at his chest, his heart pounding after he was startled. But soon he sat back down.
"I do not know. Did they see you enter?"
"No."
"Then do not worry. You have more than enough time to kill me."
Clark lowered the pistol and looked around. This place wasn't even as nice as Manfred Crome's little flat. Shit, the American thought. So little thanks for all our years of service to our countries. This old Russian spy, the old East German spy Crome, and John Clark, himself an old American spy. Three fucking peas in a pod.
I'm not going to kill you, Clark nodded toward the empty vodka bottles. You don't look like you need any help.
Kovalenko thought this over.
Then you want information.
Now Clark shrugged.
I know you met Paul Laska in London. I know your son Valentin is involved as well. Valentin follows orders from his leaders, as do you. As did I. He has nothing personal against you.
Who are those guys out there in the park?
Kovalenko said.
They were sent by Laska, I think, in order to capture you. They work for the French detective Fabrice Bertrand Morel. My son is back in London. His part in this affair was political, and it was benign. He had nothing to do with men chasing after you.
The old Russian nodded toward the gun low in Clark's right hand.
I would be surprised if my boy has ever touched a gun, he chuckled. He is so fucking civilized.
So are you in contact with the men in the street?
In contact?
No.
They came here. They told me about you. Told me you would come here, but they would protect me. I knew nothing of you before yesterday. I only set up the meeting between Valentin and Pavel. Sorry, Paul.
I was not told what was discussed.
Laska worked for the KGB in Czechoslovakia?
Clark said it as a statement. Kovalenko did not deny it. He only said,
Pavel Laska has been an enemy of every state he has ever lived in.
But John did not render judgment on Laska. The American ex-CIA man knew that the ruthless KGB could have destroyed the spirit of a young Paul Laska, turned him into something not of his own choosing. The Cold War was littered with broken men.
Oleg said, I'm going to make myself a drink if you promise you won't shoot me in the back.
Clark waved him toward his bottles, and the big Russian lumbered over to the table.
Would you like something?
No.
Kovalenko said,
So what have you learned from me? Nothing. Go back home. You will have a new president in a few weeks. He will protect you.
Clark did not say it, but he wasn't looking for protection from Jack Ryan. Quite the opposite. He needed to protect Ryan from exposure to him, to the campus. Kovalenko stood at his table and poured himself a tall, straight vodka into a water glass. He walked back over to the chair with the bottle and the glass in his hands.
I want to talk to your son. I can call his office at the embassy in London, but I doubt he'd call me back.
Kovalenko swigged half the glass and put the bottle down on the windowsill, rattling the blinds in the process.
You would have better luck calling him yourself.
The Russian seemed to Clark like he was telling the truth. He did not have much of a relationship with his son, and his son definitely was not here. Could Clark get to him in London somehow? He'd have to try. Coming to Moscow to bleed Oleg Kovalenko for information had been a dry hole. Clark slipped his gun in his pocket.
I'll leave you with your vodka. If you do talk to your boy, tell him I would like a word. Just a friendly conversation. He'll be hearing from me.
The American turned to leave through the kitchen, but the Russian pensioner called after him.
Sure you won't join me for a drink? It will warm you from the cold.
Nyet, John said as he reached the door.
Maybe we could talk about old times.
Clark's hand stopped on the door latch. He turned, walked back into the living room. Oleg cracked a little smile.
I do not get many visitors. I can't be choosy, can I?
Clark's eyes sharpened as he scanned the room quickly.
What?
His eyes stopped scanning, locked onto the vodka bottle on the windowsill. It pressed against the blinds, closing them. A signal to the men in the park.
Son of a bitch, Clark shouted,
and he shot back through the kitchen, out the door, and up the hallway. He heard noises in the stairwell, the chirping of a walkie-talkie and the slapping, echoing footfalls of two men. John ran to the top of the stairs and grabbed a heavy round metal ashtray garbage can that had been positioned there. He laid the cylinder on its side at the edge of the top stair, waited until the sounds of the men told him they were just around the corner below, and then he kicked the metal can. He just caught a glimpse of the first man turning at the landing. He wore a heavy black coat and carried a small black pistol and a radio. John drew his pistol and adopted a combat stance at the top of the stairs. The metal garbage can picked up speed as it bounced down the stairs. As the men turned onto the flight just below Clark, the can bounced head high and banged into them, sending both men crashing to the tile floor. One man dropped his pistol, but the other retained his weapon and tried to aim it up the stairwell at the man standing above them. John fired a single round. The .45 caliber bullet burned a red crease into the man's left cheek.
"Drop it!" Clark shouted in English.
The man on the tile floor below did as he was told. Along with his partner, he raised his hands into the air as he lay there. Even with the silencer on his Sig Sauer .45, the echo of Clark's pistol in the stairwell was painfully loud, and he had no doubt residents would be on the phone to the police in seconds. He descended down to the landing and stepped between the two men, keeping his pistol trained on them all the while. He liberated them of their guns and their walkie-talkies and their mobile phones. One of the men cursed Clark in French, but he kept his hands in the air while doing so, and John ignored him. John did not say another word to the men before continuing down the stairs. He exited the back door of the apartment building a minute later, and here he dumped the men's equipment in a trash can. He thought, for a fleeting hopeful moment, that he was in the clear, but a white panel truck passed by on the opposite side of the road, and then it slammed on its brakes. Four men leapt out. There were eight lanes of afternoon traffic between John and the four, but they began running through the cars, heading right for him. John broke into a run. His original objective had been the Pushkinskaya metro station, but the men were on his heels not 50 yards back, and they were a lot faster than he. The underground station would slow his escape. He would never make it on a train before they caught him. He ran across busy Tverskaya Street, eight lanes of traffic that he had to negotiate like a violent dance. On the other side of the street, he chanced a glance behind him. The four men were joined by two more in the street. The six hunters were only 25 yards back now. They were going to catch him. It was quickly becoming apparent. There were too many men. They were too well-trained, too well-coordinated, and, he had to admit, they were too motherfucking young and fit for him to outrun them all across Moscow. He could not get away from them, but he could, with a little cunning and guile, game his capture. John picked up the pace now, trying to put a little space between himself and the six behind. As he did so, he pulled the prepaid phone he'd purchased the day before from his coat pocket. The phone had an auto-answer key that set the device to pick up automatically any incoming call after two rings. He enabled this feature with a few taps of his thumb, and then he turned down a side street that ran perpendicular to Pushkin Square. It was little more than an alley, but Clark saw what he was looking for. A municipal garbage truck rolled slowly in the opposite direction after just loading up with refuse from a dumpster outside the McDonald's. John took his phone, looked down at the number on the screen, and then hurled it into the back of the truck just as it made a left behind the McDonald's. Then Clark turned into the doors of the restaurant as the men chasing him turned the corner behind. John shot through the door, ran past smiling employees asking if they could help him, and pushed through a crowd that pushed him back. He tried to escape through a side entrance, but a black sedan screeched to a halt there, and two men in black sunglasses and heavy coats emerged from the back seat. Clark ducked back into the restaurant and then headed toward the kitchen. This Pushkin Square McDonald's was the largest McDonald's in the world. It could serve 900 customers simultaneously, and Clark got the impression they were having a busy afternoon rush. Finally, he managed to make his way through the crowd and into the kitchen. In an office beyond, Clark lifted the phone and dialed the number he'd just memorized. "Come on, come on." After two rings, he heard a click and knew the call had been put through. At that moment, the six armed hunters appeared in the doorway to the office. Clark spoke loudly into the phone.
"Fabrice Bertrand Morel, Paul Laska, and Valentin Kovalenko of the SVR."
He said it again as the men closed on him, then he hung up the phone. The biggest man of the crew lifted his handgun high over his head, then brought it down hard onto the bridge of John Clark's nose. And then everything went black. Clark awoke tied to a chair in a dark room without windows. His face hurt, his nose hurt, and his nostrils seemed to be full of bloody gauze. He spit blood on the floor. There was only one reason he was still alive. His phone call had confused them. Now these men, their boss, and their employer would all be scrambling to figure out whom he had communicated with. If they killed him now, after he'd passed the information on, it would do them no good. Now they might beat him to get him to reveal his contact, but at least they would not put a bullet in his brain. Not yet, anyway. 70. The Baikonur Cosmodrome, located north of the Sirdarya River in the steppes of the former Soviet satellite state of Kazakhstan, is both the oldest and the largest spaceport on Earth. The entire grounds of the facility are roughly a circle some 50 miles in diameter, containing dozens of buildings, launch pads, hardened silos, processing facilities, tracking stations, launch control buildings, roads, an airfield, and a train station. The nearby town of Baikonur has its own airport, and another rail station is nearby in Tiratam. The first rocket launch pad was built here in the 1950s at the start of the Cold War, and from here in Baikonur, Yuri Gagarin launched to become the first man in space. The commercial space industry would not exist for another 30 years, but today, Baikonur is Russia's main hub of private commercial space operations. They rent the property out from Kazakhstan, paying not in dollars or rubles or euros, but in military equipment. Georgi Safronov had been walking the halls, standing on the pads, driving trucks across the steps here for nearly 20 years. He was the face of the new Russia when it came to outer space, not unlike Gagarin himself representing Russia's space operations a half century earlier. On his first day back at Baikonur, the day before the planned launching of the first of three Dnieper rockets in quick succession, 45-year-old Georgi Safronov sat in his temporary office in the LCC, the Launch Control Center, situated some 5 miles west of the three launch silos devoted to Dnieper launches at Baikonur. The Dnieper area, though it encompassed dozens of square miles of territory, was actually quite small when compared with the launch facilities for the Soyuz, Proton, and Rokot systems in other parts of the Cosmodrome. Georgi looked out his second-floor window at a light snowfall that obscured his view of the launch sites in the distance. Somewhere out there, three silos already contained 100-foot-tall headless rockets, but soon they would have their heads, and those three frozen concrete holes out there would become the most important and most feared place on Earth. A knock on the door to his office pulled his eyes away from the snowy vista. Alexander Verbov, Safronov's director of launch operations, leaned in the doorway.
"Sorry, Georgi. The Americans from Intelsat are here. Since I can't take them to the control room, I told them I would see if you were busy." "I would love to meet my American customers."
Safronov stood as six Americans entered the small office. He smiled graciously, shaking their hands and speaking to them one at a time. They were here to monitor the launch of their communications satellite, but in fact, their payload container containing their equipment would be switched out for a container presently sitting under guard in a train car a few miles from the Cosmodrome. As he shook hands and exchanged pleasantries, he knew that these five men and one woman would be dead very soon. They were infidels, and their death was inconsequential. But he could not help thinking, nevertheless, that the woman was quite pretty. Georgi damned his weakness. He knew his flesh would be rewarded in the afterlife. He told himself this, and he smiled into the attractive communications executive's eyes and moved on to the next American, a short, fat, bearded man with a PhD in something irrelevant. Soon the Americans were out of his office, and he returned to his desk, knowing the process would be repeated by the Japanese customers and the British clients. The LCC was officially off-limits to foreigners, but Safronov had allowed the representatives from his customers' companies some access to the second-floor offices. Throughout the day, he took full command of the preparations of the rockets. There were other people who could handle this. Georgi was president of the company, after all. But Safronov explained away his personal attention by saying this was the first Dnieper multi-launch in history, with a trio of launches during a planned window of only 36 hours, and he wanted to make sure everything went according to plan. This could, he argued, help them attract more clients in the future, if multiple companies needed their equipment launched in a specific time window. The Dnieper rockets did have the ability to take more than one satellite into space at a time, with all equipment loaded into the same spacehead module. But this was only helpful if the customers all wanted the same orbit. The three-launch schedule for the next 2 days would send satellites to the south and to the north. Or so everyone thought. No one really raised an eyebrow at Safronov's hands-on approach, as Georgi was a hands-on leader, as well as an expert on the Dnieper system. But no one knew that his expertise would rely on work he had done over a decade earlier. When the R-36 ballistic missile left service in the end of the 1980s, 308 missiles remained in the Soviet Union's inventory. Safronov's company began refitting them for space launch operations under contract from the Russian government in the late 90s. But at the time, the U.S. space shuttle program was in full gear, and America had plans for more space vehicles on the horizon. Safronov worried that his company could not make the Dnieper system profitable with commercial space launches alone, so he concocted other plans for their use. One of the ideas Safronov put forth and explored for years was the idea that a Dnieper 1 rocket could be used as a maritime life-saving device. He postulated that if, say, a ship was sinking off the coast of Antarctica, a launch of a rocket in Kazakhstan could send a pod carrying 3,000 pounds up to 12,000 miles away in under an hour, with an accuracy of under 2 kilometers. Other payloads could be sent to other parts of the globe in emergency situations, an admittedly expensive but unparalleled airmail service of sorts. He knew it sounded fanciful, so he spent months with teams of scientists working out the telemetry physics of his idea, and he had developed computer models. Ultimately, his plans went nowhere, especially after U.S. shuttle launches ceased and then only restarted slowly after the loss of the Space Shuttle Challenger. But a few months earlier, as soon as he returned from his meeting with General Ejaz, Safronov dusted off his old computer disks and put a team together to rework the mechanics of sending Dnieper vehicles into high atmosphere instead of low orbit, and then dropping them down to a particular location, parachuting a pod to Earth. His team thought it was hypothetical, but they did their job, and Safronov had the computer models and executable commands secretly loaded into the software now in use at the LCC. He took a quick call from assembly and integration. The three satellites were now out of the cleanroom and had been placed in the payload containers and fitted into the space head modules, the nose of the actual spacecraft that would, as far as the owners of the satellites knew, put their equipment into Earth orbit. These spacecraft would now be taken out to the silos in transporter erectors, large crane trucks that would make them to the launch vehicles, the huge three-stage rockets that already waited in their silos. It was a several hours long process that would not end until late in the evening, and much of the staff would be out of the LCC to oversee or just spectate at the launch sites. This would give Georgie time to coordinate with his men down in Baikonur to prepare for the attack. Everything was going according to plan so far, but Safronov expected nothing else, since every single action that he had taken was nothing less than Allah's will. The Frenchmen working for Fabrice Bertrand Morel might have been good detectives, good hunters of human prey, but as far as John Clark was concerned, they were awful interrogators. For the past 2 days, he'd been punched, kicked, slapped, denied food and water, and even denied a bathroom break. That was torture. Yes, the American's jaw was swollen and sore, and he'd lost 2 crowns. And yes, he'd been forced to piss on himself, and he was sure he'd lost enough weight in 2 days to ensure that, if he ever got up to leave this place, he'd need to make a beeline to a clothing store to get some clothes that would not fall off him. But no, these guys did not have the first idea of how to get someone to talk. John had gotten no sense from the men that they were under any time constraints from their boss. It had been the same 6 men he'd been with since the beginning. They'd stuck him in some rented house, likely not far from Moscow, and they thought they could knock him around for a couple of days to get him to reveal his contacts and his affiliations. He was asked about Jack Ryan a lot. Jack Ryan Sr., that is. He was asked about his current job. And he was asked about the Emir. He got the impression that the men asking the questions did not know enough of the context of the information that was being sought to be any good at their questioning. Someone, Laska or FBM or Valentin Kovalenko, had sent them questions to ask, so that's what they did. Ask question, get no answer, punish, repeat. Clark wasn't having any fun, but he could continue like this for a week or more before they really started to annoy him. He'd been through worse. Hell, SEAL training was much, much worse than this shit. One of the Frenchmen, the one John thought of as the nicest of the bunch, stepped into the room. He wore a black tracksuit now. The men had gone out and bought new clothes for the interrogation after Clark's sweat and blood and spit had made it onto their suits. He sat on the bed. Clark was tied in his chair.
Mr. Clark, time is running out for you. Tell me about the Emir, Monsieur Yassine. You were working with Jacques Ryan to find him, with some of your old friends from the CIA, perhaps, oui? You see, we know much about you and the organization with whom you work, but we just need a little bit more of the information. You give us this, it is no big thing to you, and then you go home.
Clark rolled his eyes.
I don't want my friends to hit you again. There is no use in this. You talk, yes?
No. Clark said it through a sore jaw that he was sure was about to get a little more sore. The Frenchman shrugged.
I call my friends. They will hurt you, Mr. Clark.
As long as they don't talk as much as you.
Georgi Safronov liked to think that he had thought through every last detail of his plan. On the morning of the realization of his plot, the 43 remaining Jamaat Shariat forces positioned nearby had already broken off into their small units, using tactics learned training with the very capable Haqqani network in Waziristan. But there were two sides to any military engagement, and Safronov had not neglected to study his adversary, the site's security force. Security for Baikonur used to be the responsibility of the Russian army, but they pulled out years earlier, and since that time, the protection of the nearly 2,000 square mile area was the job of a private company from Tashkent. The men drove around in trucks, patrolling the grounds, and they had a couple of men positioned at the front gates, and they had a large barracks building full of men. But the fence line at Baikonur was low and poor in most areas, and non-existent in others. It was not a secure environment. And although the land appeared at a distance to be nothing but wide open range, Safronov knew that the steppes were crisscrossed with dry streams and natural depressions that could be exploited. He also knew that a local Muslim insurgent force, Hizb-ut-Tahrir, had tried to enter the spaceport in the past, but they were so weak and poorly trained, they had only bolstered the delusion of the hired Kazakh guard force that they were ready for an attack. An attack was coming, Georgi knew, and he would see how ready they were. Safronov himself had befriended the leader of the guards. The man made regular visits to the Dnieper LCC when a launch was imminent, and Georgi had called the man the evening before to ask him to come by early because Cosmos Space Flight Corporation, Georgi's company, had sent a token of appreciation from Moscow for all the fine work he was doing. The director of security was thrilled, and he said he would arrive at Mr. Safronov's office at 8:30 a.m. It was now 7:45, and Safronov paced his office. He worried his human form would not be able to do what must be done now, and it made him shake. His brain told him what must be done, but he was not certain he could see it through. His phone rang, and he was glad for the interruption.
Yes? Hi, Georgi. Hello, Alexander. Do you have a moment?
I'm a little busy going over the numbers for the second launch. I won't have much time after the first launch this afternoon.
Yes, but I need to speak with you about this afternoon's launch. I have some concerns.
Damn it, not now, thought Georgi. He did not need to spend his morning dealing with a technical matter involving a satellite that would travel no farther than the distance his men dropped it next to the silo when they replaced it with their own space head module. Still, he needed to appear as if everything was normal for as long as possible.
Come in. I am at flight data processing. I can be there in 15 minutes, 20 if there is too much ice on the road.
Well, hurry up, Alexander. It took Director of Launch Operations Alexander Verbov the full 20 minutes to arrive at his president's office at the LCC. He entered without knocking, stamping his feet and pulling off his heavy coat and hat.
Fucking cold morning, Georgi, he said with a grin.
What do you need?
Safronov was running out of time. He had to get his friend out of here in a hurry.
I'm sorry to say it, but we need to cancel today's flight.
What? Why?
Telemetry is having issues with some software. They want to troubleshoot for a while, then power down and reset. Some of our data collection and processing systems will be affected for a few hours. But the next window to launch all three vehicles in quick succession, as we planned, will be in 3 days' time. I recommend we cancel the launch sequence, power down the power pressure generators, offload the fuel from all three LVs, and put the SCs in temporary storage configuration. We will have a delay, but we'll still set the record for a narrow launch window, which ultimately is our goal.
No, Safronov said. The launch sequence continues. I want 109 ready to go at noon.
Verbov was completely taken aback. This was a response unlike any he'd ever gotten from Safronov, even when the news was bad.
I do not understand, Georgi Mikhailovich. Did you not just hear me? Without proper telemetry readings, European Mission Control would never allow the spacecraft to continue their flight. They will abort the launch, you know that.
Safronov looked at his friend for a long moment.
I want it to launch. I want all missiles ready in their silos.
Verbov smiled as he cocked his head. He chuckled.
Missiles? LVs, you know what I mean. Nothing to worry about, Alexander. It will all be clear soon.
What is going on?
Safronov's hands trembled. He clutched the fabric of his pant legs. Over and over, he whispered to himself a mantra given to him by Suleiman Murshidov.
1 second of jihad equals 100 years of prayer. 1 second of jihad equals 100 years of prayer. 1 second of jihad equals 100 years of prayer.
Did you say something?
Leave me.
Alexander Verbov turned away slowly, headed out into the hallway. He'd gotten just 10 feet or so from his boss's door when Safronov called to him from his office.
I'm joking, Alex. Everything is fine. We can delay the launch if telemetry says we must.
Verbov shook his head with a snorted chuckle, something between confusion and mirth, then he returned to the office. He was through the doorway before he noticed the pistol in Safronov's hand. He gave an incredulous smile, like he did not believe the weapon was real.
Georgi Mikhailovich, what do you think you are?
Safronov fired a single round from the suppressed Makarov auto pistol. It entered Alexander's solar plexus, passed through a lung, shattered a rib as it tore out his back. Alex did not fall. He'd winced with the noise of the gunshot, hesitated a moment before looking down at the bloodstain growing on his brown coveralls. Georgi thought it took Alexander a long time to die. Neither man said a word. They only looked at each other with similar stares of bewilderment. Then Alex reached back, found the vinyl chair by the door, and sat down in it roughly. Another few seconds, and his eyes closed. His head sagged to the side, and a long final breath blew from his damaged lung. It took Georgi several more seconds to control his own breathing, but he did so, and he placed the pistol on the desk next to him. He pulled the dead man, still in his chair, into the closet in his office. He had made space for one man, the director of security, but now he would need to make more room for the Kazakh when he came in just minutes. Safronov dumped Verbov's body out of the chair and onto the floor of the closet, pushed the dead man's feet inside, and then shut the door. Hurriedly, he grabbed a roll of toilet paper in his bathroom and wiped up the drips of blood on the floor of his office. 10 minutes later, the director of security was dead as well, flat on the floor of Safronov's office. He was a big man, and he still wore his coat and his heavy boots. Georgi stared at the body, the hangdog expression on the dead man's face, and he wanted to retch. But he did not retch. He focused himself, and he dialed his mobile with a trembling hand. When the call was answered on the other end, he said,
Allahu Akbar.
It is time. 71. Without their leader, the Kazakh security force did not stand a chance. The Jamaat Shariat terrorists hit the main gate in force at 8:54 a.m. in a driving snow. They killed 4 guards posted there and destroyed 3 trucks full of reinforcements with RPGs before the Kazakhs fired a single shot. The snowfall slowed as the 6 Dagestani vehicles, 4 pickup trucks carrying 6 men each and 2 semi-trailers, each one carrying a payload container, one with 6 men and one with 7, separated at a crossroads near the launch control center. A pickup of 6 men went to the processing facility to take control of the 16 foreigners who worked for the 3 companies with satellites here at Baikonur. The 2 semis headed for the 3 launch pads, along with one of the pickups leading the way. Another 6-man unit remained at the turnoff from the main road to the Dnieper. They climbed out of their vehicles and into a low concrete bunker that was once a guard post for Russian military forces, but now lay half buried in the snowy grasses of the steppes. Here they positioned RPG launchers and scoped rifles and scanned the roads, ready to take out any vehicle from a distance. The remaining 2 6-man teams both drove to the LCC, and here they did meet stiff resistance. There were 12 security men present, and they killed 5 of the 12 attackers before finding themselves overrun. Several guards dropped their guns and raised their hands, but the Dagestanis killed the Kazakhs where they surrendered. The Kazakhs' response to the attack was horribly uncoordinated after the disappearance of their leader. Their nearby barracks did not mount a counterattack for 25 minutes, and as soon as they took the first incoming RPG round, missing the first truck as it approached the turnoff, they turned back to rethink their strategy. In the LCC, the civilians hunkered down on the 2nd floor while the attack outside raged. When the sound of execution-style killing ceased, when all the huddled Russian space launch engineers sat sobbing and praying and cursing, Georgi Safronov alone walked down the stairs. His friends and employees called out to him, but he ignored them, and he opened the door. Jamaat Shariat forces took the LCC without firing another shot. Everyone was ordered into the control room, and Georgi made an announcement.
Do as I say, and you will live. Refuse an order once, and you will die.
The men, his men, looked up to him in wide-eyed astonishment. One gunman, 1 of 3 posted by the emergency exit, raised his rifle into the air.
Allahu Akbar!
The chorus was joined by everyone in the room. Georgi Safronov beamed. He was in charge now. The first people outside the Cosmodrome to learn of the attack at Baikonur were in Darmstadt, Germany, at the European Space Operations Center, the facility that was set to direct the satellites once in orbit. They were in the middle of a live, pre-flight on-camera link-up with launch control, so they saw the LCC employees run for their lives. They also saw everyone return, with armed terrorists walking in behind them, and then the president of Cosmos Space Flight Corporation, Georgi Safronov, entering last. Safronov wore an AK-47 around his neck and was dressed head-to-toe in winter camouflage. The first thing he did upon entering the room was cut the feed to the ESOC. The launch control room of the Dnieper Launch Control Center would not impress anyone accustomed to movies and television programs of the U.S. Kennedy Space Center. A massive amphitheater with gargantuan displays on the walls and dozens of scientists, engineers, and astronauts working at flat panel displays. Dnieper rockets were launched and controlled from a room that looked something like a lecture hall in a community college. There was seating for 30 at long tables of control panels and computers. Everyone faced two large but by no means massive display panels on the front walls, one showing telemetry information, and the other a live shot of the closed silo lid at Site 109, containing the first of three Dniepers set to lift off in the next 40 hours. Snow swirled around the site, and eight armed men with rifles in white and gray camo uniforms had taken up positions on the low towers and cranes across the pad, their eyes scanning the snowy steps. Safronov had spent the last hour speaking by phone and walkie-talkie to the technical director of the processing facility, explaining exactly what was to be done at each launch site. When the man protested, when he refused to carry out Safronov's wishes, Georgi ordered one of the technical director's staff shot. After the death of his colleague, the technical director had given Georgi no more problems. "Cut the feed at 109," Georgi ordered, and the screen in front of the men at launch control went blank. He did not want the men in the room with him knowing which silos had the bombs and which rocket contained the remaining satellite. Now Safronov was about to explain everything to the staff here at the LCC.
"Where is Alexander?"
asked Maxim Ezhov, Cosmos' assistant launch director, the first man brave enough to speak.
"I killed him, Maxim. I did not want to, but my mission required it."
Everyone just stared at him as he explained the situation.
"We are putting new payloads into the SHCs. This will be done at the launch sites. My men are overseeing this now, and the technical director of the processing facility is leading his men. Once he says he is complete, I will go out to the launch silos and check his work. If he has done what I asked him to do, he and his entire staff will be free to go."
The launch team stared at the president of Cosmos Spaceflight Corporation.
"You do not believe me, do you?"
Some of the men just shook their heads no.
"I anticipated this. Gentlemen, you have known me for many years. Am I an evil man?"
"No," one of them said, a hopeful note in his voice.
"Of course not. Am I a pragmatic, efficient, intelligent man?"
Nods all around.
"Thank you. I want to show you that I will give you what you want, if you give me what I want."
Georgi lifted his radio.
"Let everyone Russian and Kazakh remaining at the processing facility go free. They may take their personal vehicles, of course. I am sorry, but the buses will have to remain. There are many more people here who will require transport from the facility when this is all over."
He listened to his subordinate acknowledge the order and then said,
"And please, ask them all to call the switchboard here when they are out of the spaceport to tell their friends here at the LCC that it was no trick. I have no desire to hurt anyone else. The men here at the Cosmodrome are my friends."
The launch control facility personnel relaxed in front of him. Georgi was feeling magnanimous.
"You see? Do what I ask and you will live to see your families."
"What will we be doing?" asked Ezhov, now the de facto leader of the hostages in launch control.
"You will do what you came here to do. You will prepare to launch three rockets."
No one asked what was happening, though some had their suspicions about what was going to be loaded on their space vehicles. Safronov was just as he said, an efficient and pragmatic man. He allowed the staff at the processing facility to go free because he did not need them any longer, and he needed his troops guarding the staff at processing to move to the launch silos to protect them from Spetsnaz. And he also knew this show of goodwill would make it more likely the launch control personnel would follow orders. When he did not need the controllers any longer, however, he would have no incentive to let them live. he would kill them all as part of his statement to the infidels in Moscow. The ESOC in Darmstadt reported the attack to its counterparts in Moscow, among others, and Moscow notified the Kremlin. After an hour of discussions over the phone, a direct link with the Kremlin was established. Safronov found himself standing in launch control with a headset on, conversing with Vladimir Gamov, the director of the Russian Federal Space Agency, who was at the Kremlin in a hastily organized crisis center. The two men had known each other for as long as Safronov could remember.
"What is going on over there, Georgi Mikhailovich?"
Safronov answered.
"You can begin by calling me Magomed Dagestani."
Mohammed the Dagestani. In the background on the other end of the line, Safronov heard someone mumble, "Sukin si, son of a bitch." This made him smile. Right now it would be sinking into everyone in the Kremlin that three Dnieper rockets were under control of North Caucasus separatists.
"Why, Georgi?
Are you too stupid to see?
To understand?
Help me understand. Because I am not Russian. I am a Dagestani."
"That is not true.
I have known your father since we were at St. Petersburg, since you were a child."
"But you met my father after I was adopted from Dagestani parents, Muslims. My life has been a lie, and it is a lie that I will rectify now."
There was a long pause. Men mumbled in the background. The director went in a different direction with the conversation.
"We understand you have 70 hostages."
"That is not correct.
I have released 11 men already, and I will release another 15 as soon as they return from the silos, which should be within a half hour at most."
"At the silos? What are you doing to the rockets?"
"I am threatening to launch them against Russian targets."
"They are space vehicles. How will you..."
"Before they were space vehicles, they were R-36s, intercontinental ballistic missiles. I have returned them to their former glory."
"The R-36 carried nuclear weapons, not satellites, Safronov."
Georgi paused for a long moment.
"That is correct.
I should have been more accurate in my words. I have returned two of these specimens to their former glory. The third rocket does not have a warhead, but it is a powerful kinetic missile nonetheless."
"What are you saying?"
"I am saying I have two 20-kiloton nuclear bombs, loaded into the space head modules of two of the three Dnieper 1 delivery vehicles in my possession. The missiles are in their launch silos, and I am in launch control. The weapons, I call them weapons because they are no longer mere rockets, are targeting population centers of Russia."
"These nuclear weapons you speak of?"
"Yes. They are the missing bombs from Pakistan. My Mujahideen fighters and I took them. Our understanding from the Pakistanis is that the weapons cannot detonate in their current state."
"You are bluffing.
If you even have the bombs, you cannot use them."
Safronov had expected this. The Russians were so dismissive of his people, after all. He would have been stunned if it were any different.
"In 5 minutes, I will send an email to you directly, and the subdirectors of your agency, that is to say, men more intelligent than you. In the file, you will see the decoding sequence we used to render the bombs viable warheads. Share it with your nuclear experts. They will attest to its accuracy. In the file, you will also see digital photographs of the altimeter fuses we stole from the WA Cantonment Armaments Factory. Share them with your munitions experts. And in the file, you will also see several possible trajectory plots for the Dnieper rockets, in case you do not believe I can return the payloads to Earth wherever I want. Show that to your rocket engineers. They will spend the rest of the day with their calculators, but they will see."
Safronov did not know if the Russians believed him. He expected more questioning, but instead, the director of the Russian Federal Space Agency just said,
"Your demands?"
"I want proof that the hero of the Dagestani Revolution, Israfil Nabayev, is alive. You give me this, and I release several more hostages. When you release Commander Nabayev and he is delivered here, I will release everyone else here except for a skeleton crew of technicians. When you remove all Russian forces from the Caucasus, I will take one of the nuclear-tipped Dniepers offline. And when myself, Commander Nabayev, and my men have safely left the area, I will relinquish control of the other weapon. This situation that you find yourself in can be behind you in a matter of a few short days.
I will need to discuss this with..."
"You may discuss this with whoever you want. But remember this.
I have 16 foreign prisoners here. 6 are from the United States, 5 are from Great Britain, and 5 are from Japan. I will begin executing the prisoners unless I speak with Nabayev by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I will release the missiles unless Russia has quit the Caucasus in 72 hours. Dobry den. Good afternoon.
72. In the beautiful library of Paul Laska's Newport, Rhode Island home, the aged billionaire cradled the handset of his telephone at his desk, and he listened to the low ticking of the Bristol mahogany grandfather clock in the hallway. Time ticking away. It had been 5 days since Fabrice Bertrand Morel had reported that Clark had found Kovalenko and learned of Laska's involvement in the dossier passed to the Keelty administration. In those 5 days, Bertrand Morel had called every 12 hours with the same story. The grizzled spy has not talked about his contacts, has not revealed whom he told or what he told them. Each time, Laska added more questions for the French to ask the man, more things that, if only revealed, could create some sort of leverage for Laska in case the news of his conspiring with the Russians made it into the wrong hands. It was no longer about defending the Emir, and no longer about destroying Jack Ryan, though Paul hoped for that even now. No, at this point, the Czech immigrant was concerned for his own survival. Things had not gone according to plan. The FBI had fucked up the arrest of Clark, and FBM had fucked up the capture of Clark since he had already learned about Laska and passed that info on. And now, Paul Laska decided, it was time to end this game. He lifted the phone from the receiver and dialed a number written on the blotter in front of him. He'd had the number since the beginning, and he had doubted he would ever need to use it, but now it was unavoidable. 4 rings, and then a mobile phone in London was answered.
Yes?
Good evening, Valentine. This is Paul.
Hello, Paul. My sources tell me there's a problem.
Your sources include your father, I assume?
Yes.
Then yes, there is a problem. Your father spoke to Clark.
Clark should not have made it to Moscow. Your mistake, not mine.
Fair, Valentine. I'll accept that.
But let's deal with the world as it is, not as we would like it to be.
There was a long pause. Why did you call?
We have Clark. We are holding him in Moscow, trying to find out just what our exposure is on this.
That sounds prudent.
Yes, well, the men working for us are not interrogators. They have fists, yes, but I am thinking you would have some expertise that would be very helpful.
You think I torture people?
I don't know if you do or not, though I can imagine it is in your DNA. Many people talked after a few hours in a basement with your father.
I am sorry, Paul, but my organization needs to limit its exposure in this enterprise. Your side has lost. The developing situation in Kazakhstan is occupying the concerns of everyone in my nation right now. The excitement about bringing down Jack Ryan has passed.
Laska fumed.
You cannot just walk away from this, Valentine. The operation is not complete.
It is for us, Paul.
Don't be a fool. You are in as deep as I am. Clark gave your name to his contact.
My name is, unfortunately, a matter of record in the CIA. He can say what he wants.
Now Laska could hide his fury no longer.
Perhaps, but if I make one telephone call to The Guardian, you will be the most recognizable Russian agent in Britain.
You are threatening to out me as SVR.
Laska did not hesitate.
You as SVR and your father as KGB. I'm sure there are still some angry people in the satellites that would love to know who is responsible for the death of their loved ones.
You are playing a dangerous game, Mr. Laska. I am willing to forget about this conversation, but do not test me. My resources are
nothing like my resources. I want you to take custody of Clark. Then I want you to find out who he is working for, what his present connection to Ryan is, and then you make him disappear so he cannot speak about what he has learned in the past month.
Or what?
Or I make phone calls in the United States and in Europe revealing what you've been up to.
That is a poor bluff. You can't reveal your involvement. You have broken laws in your country. I have broken no laws in mine.
In the past 40 years, I've broken laws that you cannot imagine, my young friend. And yet I continue. I will survive this. You will not.
Kovalenko did not reply.
Laska said, make him talk. Cut off all the loose ends. Clean this up and we can all move on.
Kovalenko started to say something, to grudgingly agree to look into the matter personally, but to make clear that he would not commit to any particular measure. But Laska hung up the phone. The old man knew Valentin Kovalenko would follow orders. Georgi knew from the very beginning that the FSB's Alpha Group would attempt to retake control of the facility. His fertile mind could have guessed as much, even if he had not witnessed a mock FSB raid to retake the Soyuz facility from a terrorist organization just 3 years prior. He had no reason to be involved in the Soyuz operation, but he had been in Baikonur at the time on other business, and he was invited by facility officials to witness the exercise. He'd watched it all with incredulous fascination, the helicopters and the overland movement of the camo-clad forces, the concussion grenades and the rappelling from the roof of the building. He talked to some Soyuz engineers after the drill and had learned more about the Russian contingency plan in the unlikely event terrorists ever took control of the complex. Safronov knew there was also a chance Moscow would simply decide to fight fire with fire and nuke the entire cosmodrome in order to save Moscow. Fortunately for his plan, the Dnieper launch site at Baikonur was the original launch site of the R-36 and was therefore built to withstand a nuclear attack. Sites 104, 103, and 109 contained hardened silos from which the missiles launched, and the launch control facility was built with thick reinforced concrete walls and blast-proof steel doors. At 6 p.m. on the first day, 8 hours after the facility was overtaken by Dagestani terrorists, a pair of Russian FSB Alpha Group Mi-17 helicopters landed on the far side of the Proton rocket facilities, 25 kilometers from the Dnieper LCC. 24 operators, 3 teams of 8, climbed out, each man laden with 60 pounds of gear and covered in white winter camouflage. Within minutes, they were heading east. Shortly after 8 o'clock in the evening, an Antonov AN-124 transport aircraft landed at Yubilenya Airfield northwest of the Baikonur-Dnieper facility. The AN-124 was the largest cargo aircraft on Earth, and the Russian military needed every inch of the cabin space and cargo hold for the 96 Spetsnaz assault troops and all their gear, including 4 assault vehicles. 4 more Mi-17 helicopters arrived an hour later, along with a refueling aircraft. The 24 men in the white camo had been traversing the Baikonur steppes throughout the evening, first in heavy four-wheelers handed over by the Kazakhs. But as they got closer, they left the vehicles behind and marched through the snow-covered grassland in the dark. By 2 a.m., they were in position, waiting for a go code from their leadership. Safronov had spent a busy afternoon giving orders to his gunmen, as well as the launch control engineers. After loading the nuclear devices into the spacehead modules, he'd release the rest of the processing team. This decision, and his decision to have the foreign hostages brought to the LCC, allowed him to consolidate his men. He had 4 Jamaat Shariat men at the Crossroads bunker, 4 at Silo 109, 10 each at Silos 103 and 104, and 15 at the LCC. He ordered his men to sleep in shifts, but he knew even those men sleeping would do so with one eye open. He expected the attack to come in the middle of the night, but did not know if it would be this evening or the next. He knew that, before the attack itself, he would be contacted by the Russians in order to occupy his attention at that critical moment. So when he was awoken by a ring and a flashing light on the comms control board to which his headset was attached, his heart began to pound. Sitting on the floor against the wall with his AK in his lap, he leapt to his feet. Before he answered the call, he reached for his radio. He broadcast to all of his Dagestani brethren, "They are coming! Be ready!" And then he screamed at all the prisoners in the launch control room, most of whom were sleeping on the floor, "Everyone to your positions! I want 109 ready to launch in 5 minutes or I start shooting. Onboard telemetry up. Separation systems armed. LV pyro armed." "Yes, sir," replied several of the launch control directors as they executed the commands, their hands trembling. Bleary-eyed men in rumpled clothing scrambled to their seats as Dagestani gunmen waved rifles at them. While this was going on, Georgi Safronov grabbed his headset and placed it to his ear. In a sleepy voice that he found hard to fake with the adrenaline in his bloodstream, he said,
"Yes? What is it?"
The 24 men who had spent the last 8 hours humping overland hit the LCC on 3 sides, corresponding to the main entrance, the rear entrance, and an equipment loading bay. Each entryway was protected by 3 Dagestani rebels, and they had warning from their leader that the attack was coming. The men at the front entrance started firing into the night as soon as the call came, a mistake that benefited them greatly, as it gave the Alpha Group men, still just at the far edge of the snow-covered parking lot, the false impression that they had been spotted. All 8 men took cover behind cars and fired back at the open doorway, effectively pinning down both forces. The rear door was breached by the second Russian team. They tossed flashbangs through the doorway before entering, but they found themselves facing a long, narrow corridor of reinforced concrete.